Accession number 28361, reel 15.
General Julian Thompson, reel 15. You were saying you didn't have very much to do with the population of Aden.
Yeah. No, we didn't really have much to do with the population, except, you know, with the shopkeepers and people like that. No, we didn't.
You mentioned also that you were involved in dealing with the mutinies in Tanganyika. Now, what happened on that occasion?
Well, I wasn't there then. I'd gone by then. So I didn't get involved in those. Mm-hmm. But do you want to know what happened?
Well, if you have a...
I mean, what happened was that the Tanganyikan army and part of, I think, of the Kenya army in East Africa decided to mount a coup against the ruler. And Julius Nyerere, I think, was the president of what was still, I think, called Tanganyika. And he asked for British assistance, and 45 Commando was sent across in a carrier, not a LPA, not a helicopter carrier, just an ordinary fixed-wing carrier, the Victorious, I think. They took some helicopters with them from Aden, and they landed and put the mutiny down by firing a rocket launcher round into the roof of the guardroom, and that was the end of the mutiny.
What had happened to you then? Had you been
I was posted to England, to another commando, where I became the adjutant.
Mm. Which commando was that?
43 Commando, which doesn't exist anymore.
Mm. And that was new to you, wasn't it?
That commando, I'd never been in that commando.
Never been in that one
no.
before.
Mm. And it was a new commando which had been in existence in the war and been disbanded at the end of the Second World War and was reformed in 1961, and I took over as adjutant in the autumn of 62.
What were the main duties you had to perform as adjutant?
Well, the adjutant, in those days, there were no operations officer. Mm. So on operations or exercises, you were fulfilling the task of the ops officer for the CO. And in peacetime, in quotation marks, i.e. back in barracks, you were the chap who was responsible, really, for the sort of discipline and running of the commando. And if you were a good adjutant, you ran it, more or less. I mean, the CO obviously commanded it, but you implemented what he wanted done.
Would that make you the equivalent of what the Americans call an XO, an executive officer?
Well, yes, except the XO of a battalion is the second in command, isn't he?
Not always.
Not always. Mm. No. I mean, I suppose you were certainly not quite the same as the executive officer of a ship, i.e. the commander or first lieutenant. It was sort of somewhere in between. You ran the show. The day-to-day running of the setup was yours. And you were responsible for discipline for... All the what used to be called the A side. That's the
personnel,
what is it?
I suppose.
The personnel side.
Personnel management.
Personnel management side. Mm. And also you were the CO's principal staff officer. Mm. So you drafted his letters. You made certain that the paperwork of the commando was done correctly. That you know, when higher formation wrote to you and said, you know, how many left-handed, red-headed Irishmen have you got? And, you know, you were the chap responsible for. You were the point of contact with the outside world, with the commando. Mm. And though you were, and I was, in fact, quite a lot junior to the company commanders, you actually, when you spoke to the company commanders, you were actually your CO's mouthpiece. Mm. So it's a very busy job.
Sounds like it could be quite difficult if you were having to deal with those who are senior and more experienced on that sort of basis.
Well, not really, because, you know, it was part of the institution. I mean, one of the great strengths, I think, of the British army and marine staff system is that the principal staff officer to the commander is junior to the next level of commander. So the brigade major is junior to COs. Mm. The G1 of a division is or whatever they call them now, I suppose they call it an SO1, is junior to the brigade commanders. Mm. Mm. And so it's quite, one's brought up with the fact that the principal staff officer, whether he's the brigade major or the whatever they call a corps commander, the brigadier general staff of a corps, is what I would call it, what I call something else now, is the mouthpiece of his commander, and so anything that he says is taken as coming from the commander.
Mm. How did you take to this work then?
Well, I mean, I was astonished when somebody said, "You're going to be the adjutant," because I never thought I'd find myself doing that. I actually enjoyed it, because you have, it's what you make it. Mm. Because literally nothing that goes on isn't your business. Mm. It's very good training for becoming a CEO yourself, because you know how a commando works. You're responsible for making it work. So you know the sort of inside out of that, and you get involved in all the business of running the commanding officer's orderly room when he deals with people who've been bad boys and good boys, and you get to know the military legal system pretty well. And in my day, I don't think they do it now, but the adjutant used to prosecute at court martials.
Mm. Did you have many of those?
We had several, yes. Mm. I mean, not hundreds, but certainly half a dozen, I think. Mm.
What sort of things?
Oh, they were absence without leave was the big one. Mm. I can't remember anything more serious than that. Mm. If it was a serious court martial or a serious offence, I think there was one. I can't remember what the case was, but the prosecution would be done by an army legal service chap, mm. and you'd be the assistant prosecutor, and the defence would be usually a civilian lawyer would be brought in, or a barrister, mm. and then the court martial president would be assisted by a judge advocate general.
Mm. Who did you have to help here doing all this work?
Well, I had an assistant adjutant, mm. who was a lieutenant. I was a lieutenant when I started the job as adjutant. I was made an acting captain.
What did you do with him then? What
well, he dealt with the really dreary, dull bit of the records, mm. the sort of manning, the number crunching to make certain that we were up to strength, the minutiae, the detail. And then I also had an orderly room colour sergeant, who was a clerk, mm. who sort of managed the registry with all the files and looked after the typists and the clerks, was in charge of them. Mm. And then of course my other very important right hand man, really on the discipline side, was the RSM. Mm.
I was going to say, what is the division of responsibilities here between the RSM and the adjutant? Because both are responsible in a formal way for discipline, aren't they?
Yes, the RSM is really sort of to use a sort of slang, the Rottweiler. I mean, he's out there sort of dealing with people face to face. I mean, the adjutant is as well sometimes, but the RSM is everywhere and turns up at the most unexpected times and places when people least expect him to arrive. He's the chap who is at the coal face, pulling people up and monitoring people, running the sergeant's mess, responsible for the tone of the sergeant's mess, keeping an eye on all the senior NCOs and making certain they do their jobs properly. And is probably much more hands-on than the adjutant, actually, who's doing very much the same as that, only probably with the officers. Mm. But at the same time, saying to the RSM, look, I'm not very happy with the way the guard is doing its duties, get in amongst them and sort them out. Mm. And then, of course, I also had a provost sergeant who looked after the regimental police.
Mm. And was he under your direct?
He was under my direct, yeah.
Did you have any difficulty with officers' discipline?
No, no. None that I can remember, no.
And so you're the point of contact with next level up, which is brigade.
Yeah.
And then also at the same time you're delivering downwards to company commanders.
Yeah, sure, sure. Mm. Indeed. And to a degree, one was also being dealt with on what I would call Royal Marine matters by the direct, I can't remember what it was called in those days, but it was the Royal Marine headquarters in London. Mm. On sort of, you know, what sort of cap badges you're going to wear, what sort of uniforms, mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing.
It sounds like regimental matters.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Mm.
And you were saying that in the field you were ops officer. Now, what does an ops officer do?
Well, the ops officer runs the battalion headquarters and is in the field, or the commander headquarters in the field, and he is again the CO's principal staff officer. So you're responsible for making certain that the orders are produced, if they're written orders produced, for assembling and organising O groups, for running the actual headquarters in you know, the battle boards are in the right place, the thing works, so it can move and get together and put itself up and take itself down and move to the next place. And that all the cogs and bits in it, like the signalers and protection and regimental police and all that sort of thing, are working correctly, so that the CO doesn't have to worry about the actual running of it. He can get on running the actual show itself, and the instrument which enables him to run it is ticking over properly, and so the adjutant's responsible for that.
What now, the headquarters in the field, and what would the headquarters in the field, if you're on exercise or operations, what would it consist of?
Well, it consists of a couple of Land Rovers with a sort of penthouse tent that went behind it, and then it would have battle boards with maps on them and a couple of canvas chairs sort of pinned to the side or stuck to the side of the vehicle.
What's a battle board like? Is this
it's a large board in those days covered with talc, behind which you put maps and you drew on with China graph pencils. And then it would have stake boards like you know, the strengths of the companies, returns, other bits of information.
And would this battle board be on? Would they be on easels, or would they be flat on a table or something of that sort?
They were in the headquarters that I ran. They were hooked to the side of the Land Rover.
Oh, they just hung onto the vehicle.
Just hung onto the vehicle. Mm. So when you moved, they were put together, thrown into the trailer, and the vehicle drove off. Mm. Now that was, of course, if you were near a road and using vehicles. If you were if you were on your feet, as we were quite a lot of the time, then the adjutant's the battle board was a board, you know, it was your map case.
Yes.
Which you carried around, and you had, you had in basket, out basket, two pockets at the front of your combat jacket.
And you're mentioning issue orders. Was it the normal thing to issue written orders, or were most orders issued verbally when you were on exercise or operation?
Well, at the beginning of the operation, there would probably be a written order. Mm. And after that, there'd be verbal orders. Mm.
And how many people would there be in this headquarters?
With signalers and protection party and all that lot, I suppose 30 people, something like that.
The protection party would be what, a couple of sections?
A couple of sections, yeah.
Mm. And they would be just immediate?
They would be people who are either doing some other job from which they could be spared, or which was not relevant to what we were doing in action. Mm. So they could be, you know, the sort of the officers' mess, waiters and dining hall attendants, and perhaps if you were not taking a lot of vehicles, drivers without their vehicles. So you'd have to rustle together a protection party to look after the headquarters. Mm.
And so the actual personnel doing the decision making and so forth, handling the information in the core of it would be
the adjutant, the IO,
yes,
the signals officer, and that was it.
Who was responsible for actually updating the battle boards?
There'd be a watchkeeper who would be either, we used to take it in turns, I mean, I and the signals officer and the IO and who else, I'm just trying to remember whether there's another. But between us, we would be watchkeeping in the command post.
And would the commanding officer normally be in the command post, or would he be out and about?
Both, either in there or out and about.
What was the signal set up then? Did you have a signals office nearby or attached to the headquarters?
The signals officer, I'm just trying to think, would have if he could, he'd have a vehicle.
Yes.
With a little you know, sort of CP tent where he'd be handling all the signal traffic, particularly if we were getting any written traffic coming in at all in the form of paper. He'd be handling the formal messages that were coming in, and he'd be running the signal setup from there. But the hub would be the unit command net station that was actually in the CP.
So that would be your downward link, forward link.
Yeah, and then you'd have a rear link, in there as well.
Ah, so
and that would probably be remoted in from another vehicle. So the actual rear link set would probably be in another vehicle, but they'd remote it into the CP.
On a long lead.
On a long lead, yeah.
So you'd have rear link, forward link, battle boards, and about three officers at any available.
Yes. But they wouldn't all be on at one time, of course, unless they were very busy, because they'd either be asleep or eating or getting on with their other job.
Yeah. And if you had to suddenly pack up and move, you said sling the battle boards in the back of the trailer and things like that, how long would it take to actually get the penthouse packed away and all the clobber packed so that you were ready to move?
Half an hour? Not long.
And then once you
got better and better at it, you know, as you went along.
Once you'd move, how long to set up?
Half an hour.
Half an hour. And how many signalers would you have involved in servicing this?
You'd have, I'm just trying to think, on depending how many nets you had in there, but you know, because you might have a gunner net, you might have an air net, but it was the sort of basic nets you're talking about. The UCN forward, one signaler, the rear link, that's another. Then you've probably got them watchkeeping, so that's probably four times that number of signalers to maintain a watchkeeping routine.
That's about 15 or 16.
Yeah.
So they in effect would be the largest element.
They're the largest single element, yes. And of course, the signal troop also provided the rear link operators with companies as well. So the UCN operator with the rifle company would be from the signal troop, whereas the signalers within the company were company signalers.
What were 43 Command actually doing when you...
role was Strategic Reserve, part of the UK Strategic Reserve. Which was quite large in those days. I mean, it included the whole of 16 Parachute Brigade and 19 Brigade and loads of other people. I mean, there were lots of people who were part of the UK Strategic Reserve. And so we took our turns being Spearhead Battalion and doing all the sort of things that the Strategic Reserve does. We never actually went anywhere. We went to Norway on exercise and did exercise all over the place. But we never actually went anywhere exciting. We went to North Africa on exercise. Yes, I forget that. We went to North Africa on exercise as well.
Was that back to Libya or somewhere else?
Libya again.
Was it the same training?
Exactly the same training area. We went by in HMS Albion, which was then a new LPH to carry commandos and helicopters, and we did a helicopter assault.
Was this the first time you'd done one of those?
No, I'd done some before, again in 43 Commando, but not from an LPH, from up on Salisbury Plain or one of those training areas.
Because you haven't really mentioned helicopters in this sort of role before.
No,
the beginning of helicopter.
Yes, the first ever helicopter assault by the Brits in anger was in Suez. And then that was the genesis of the LPH, the Landing Platform Helicopter, the commando ship, as it was called. HMS Bulwark was the first, followed by Albion. And
what was the first time then you had
the first time I experience? Well, the first time I had any experience of helicopters was actually, funnily enough, in Malta in 1954, when a helicopter was brought along, sort of, this is a helicopter, this is what it looks like, and this was what it might do, and we sort of rode around in it, and that was it. The next time I had an experience of helicopters, really, was in 4-3 Commando at this time that we're talking about.
Yeah, that's 8 years.
8 years, by which time the sort of the thing had moved. Sorry, I'd also had experience of helicopters once in Aden when we did an exercise with helicopters.
What were the helicopters doing?
They were
whirlwinds. Occasion?
They came across in the LPH from Singapore, where it was based, and they did an exercise with us.
What was their role in that? Was it troop transport?
Oh, just troop transport. I mean, the whirlwind had such a sort of minuscule lift. I think on that particular exercise, there were three of us in the back of the helicopter.
What about with 43 Commander? What were the types of?
Well, the helicopters we worked with then were whirlwinds and the first Wessex helicopter, the early Mark of Wessex, which didn't have a very big lift, but it was better than the whirlwind. And we did a couple of exercises with them, and then we used helicopters on an exercise in Norway, an American helicopter squadron.
And were you doing assault from the helicopters at that stage, or was it just...
Yes.
You were?
Yeah.
How would you do that? How would you arrange an
assault? Well, this again was where the adjutant earned his pay. The CO told you what his plan was, and then you looked at the plan and then divided everybody up into what we call sticks, which is the same as a parachute stick, only they're not going to parachute, and loads. So the whole commando, those bits that are going to go by helicopter, are divided up into sticks. And what you do is you say to the company commanders, I want your, what's known as your stick or bat. In other words, how are you going to organise your company to get them ashore? You know, I don't do that for them, they do that for me. And they bring me then all the whole company layout, how they're going to get their company, how they'd like to see their company fly ashore. And then you put that all together, like a giant jigsaw, into the commando helicopter landing table. How you're going to move that lot by helicopter, which will include people, stores, underslung loads,
transport,
and anything that could be. If you lift the thing by helicopter, it goes with that. But you also have to work out the surface assault table, which is how you get the heavier loads ashore by landing craft. So you're producing a landing table. It's called a landing table, and that's the adjutant's job. Or used to be until ops officers were invented. It's now their job.
And when the troops went ashore by helicopter, was the idea that the helicopter would dump them on top of the enemy possessions or some distance from any enemy possessions?
The idea was you didn't land them right on top of enemy positions because they all get shot down. And the massacre would ensue. So you landed them as close as you could without them being under direct observed fire from the enemy. That was the British idea, because we didn't have too many helicopters and we didn't want to lose them.
And you didn't have the idea of the helicopter gunship?
The helicopter gunship had not come in at that stage. It didn't exist.
Of course, this is rather like, I think, the debate over how to use the armored personnel carrier, whether you deploy from it and then attack on foot.
Yes.
Or whether you drive onto the enemy position in the vehicle and then debouch once you've arrived.
Yes, I think that debate is similar and of course has largely gone away with the introduction of the fight, you know, the infantry combat vehicle where you actually fight from the vehicle, don't you, on the position. But it was considered to be a bad thing to do, to try and land a helicopter right on top of an enemy position, because you were going to lose the helicopter. And of course, the helicopter got even less protection than any sort of vehicle.
But it would give you the advantage of surprise, presumably, if you were to...
If you could get away with it.
Yes.
But the chances are you wouldn't.
Mm.
Because, you know, one man with a rifle could knock down a helicopter.
Mm.
So it was regarded as being bad news to do that.
Mm. And if the helicopter's not knocked down, then the men inside are lost as well.
Yeah, probably.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. So the idea then really is that this is a transport which takes you to the assembly area.
Yeah.
And there you form up, and from there you and go on to advance to combat.
Exactly.
What was it like living on HMS Albion? Was it well designed for carrying troops?
Yes, I mean, she'd been converted from a fixed wing carrier.
Yes.
She wasn't purpose built.
Mm.
Can I just go and get some water? Because I'm a bit drying up a bit.
Of course. I was asking you about living conditions on the Albion.
Living conditions were very cramped for the troops, particularly.
Mm.
In a typical living space for a marine would be his bunk and a small locker, and he was required to have all his kit, you know, pack and equipment, webbing equipment, weapon, the whole lot, and really the conditions were pretty grim.
Mm.
Triple tier bunks, and some of the mess decks they lived on, which were right under the flight deck, were very hot.
Mm.
It was like living under a tin roof, particularly if you got into the tropics. The air conditioning was not terribly good. The ship's fresh water system was not up to producing sufficient water for all the number of men that were additional to what the ship had originally been built to take in terms of numbers. And really, I think life on the OPHs was not all that not good, particularly for the chaps.
Mm.
The officers were slightly better off in that they could use the wardroom.
Yes.
And the accommodation was slightly better.
Mm.
But they were a lash up, really. They weren't designed to be LPHs, but they survived for a very long time as LPHs.
You mentioned going to Norway.
Yes.
That was an
exercise in the summer.
Mm.
It wasn't a winter exercise, and it was in August, I think.
Yeah.
Something like that.
It can still be quite wintry in certain parts of
Norway. It can be exceedingly wintry and cold and wet, and indeed it was.
Mm.
But it was, of course, light most of the time.
Mm.
And I think it got dark at about 11:30 at night and started getting light at about 2 in the morning, so there wasn't much night.
Where were you then?
We were quite a long way north. Yes, we were in north of Bardufoss, so we were pretty far north actually.
Yeah.
It was an exercise on our feet, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So we walked big distances over the mountains, and at one stage we had the use of some American helicopters.
Mm. And what were you exercising?
We were actually the enemy to the Norwegians. We were actually, as it were, taking the part of the Soviet, of the Warsaw Pact, except we weren't in armoured vehicles, we were on our feet.
Mm.
And we had to do a long approach march over the mountains in order to come in behind our Norwegian defensive position.
Mm.
And then we advanced, following the Norwegians as they withdrew down the coast road, as they would have done, you know, in reality.
And so, did you do an amphibious assault then?
No.
To get ashore?
No. We went to Norway by air to Bardufoss, in Britannia's, courtesy of the Royal Air Force. We then were based in a Norwegian barracks, and then we were bussed, which took all day, to our kick-off point, which was north of Bardufoss, and I can't remember exactly where it was. And we were thrown out of the buses, and we then camped by a river. I mean, you know, we just slept out in the open by this river. And the next morning we set off to go over the mountain, which took us 2 days.
Mm. Was it assumed that you had landed?
It was assumed, it was assumed that we had come through from Finland.
Through the Finnish wedge?
Yeah. Yeah, so our kick-off point was launching us it was assumed that's how we'd come.
And so were you inland then, or had you...
Oh,